Hi and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And our icebreaker question, it's inspired by an infographic which shows how our critical infrastructure are all interconnected. Gas, oil, electric, transportation, water, emergency services, and people are saying we're one hack away from Armageddon. How do you imagine the impact it'll be? Do you think we'll feel it immediately, or it'll be a slow domino effect?
This is Forrest, and I don't know. I think it really depends kind of where in this web something like that happens. It could be something that causes like a big market shakeup for a week, and some contracting company actually stands to make some money fixing something, you know? So I don't know if any of these, I think, would completely decimate everything, but there's a lot of damage to be done for sure.
This is Chris. I would agree with Forrest. That diagram definitely is a little bit spooky in terms of how interconnected everything actually is. I would hope we're not one large hack away from Armageddon. I would say we're probably more vulnerable than we should be at this point. And I hope that people in charge of this are, you know, taking that into account at this point, especially with the fact that this is, that kind of catastrophic hack has occurred in other countries before, from what I've been reading. And we just need to make sure that we're, ahead of the curve on what people are trying to do and in terms of getting into that critical infrastructure and causing damage.
This is Jeff. I don't think we're one hack away from a complete breakdown of governmental services and social structures. And I think the capacity for a terrorist organization or whoever bad people are out there to do that is probably unlikely. But those are probablys, and there is always a possibility, and we need to make sure that we're on guard for any of those things that could possibly happen. Make sure our stuff is protected.
Thanks, guys. And for our regular listeners, if you enjoy our show, if you can rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit veronis.com/review. So back to how drastic our threat landscape has changed. In Recode, they wrote an article about how our current security practices are no longer acceptable because of our data growth, and we don't have enough capable humans to respond to security risks, that potentially we can turn to robots and AI to help with incident reviews and alerts. But later, towards the end of the article, the author suggested that we needed to enlist force fields. I'm not sure what he meant by force fields meant. Maybe robots might not be enough. I wanted to hear your thoughts.
I think that towards the end, when the author was talking about force fields, I think the kind of point they were trying to make was that, it's not enough to think about using sort of the structures that we currently have access to, the current tools we have access to. I mean, now we can build walls. We can't build force fields. And I think kind of the point was maybe about, we need to be integrating maybe security tools that we frankly just don't have right now, just based on kind of like where, research and development might be. The problem is, I think this sort of alluded to in the article, and actually I'm kind of a broken record on this kind of topic, but I think we mentioned kind of earlier in the article about how in the U.S., with so much critical infrastructure being sort of like under maybe corporations as opposed to the government, there's less ability to kind of mandate, that security is kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Short up and frankly extremely secure. And I mean, the problem is, there's a lot of companies out there that I think are, their development investment into security is based on, I think kind of word for word out of there, is based more on avoiding legal liability sometimes than actually securing potentially critical infrastructure.
I think it's interesting that we're living in a world where pretty much everybody has or has multiple devices that could be compromised. People who are in different organizations, even if you're running a business or something like that, you probably have some sort of IT infrastructure, even if it's the smallest business ever. You're still working with technology. You still have the capability of, an attack hitting you, no matter how small you actually are. Whether or not that's going to be likely or not is hard to determine. But I think everybody has vulnerabilities if you think about it that way. If you think about the ratio of companies that are out there to the number of security professionals who are able to actually, handle the attacks that are, potentially moving around or that are able to cause damage out there, I think it is pretty cool that they mentioned, machines can do a better job at this. I think we may have to resort to that at some point, just because of the outpacing of the number of vulnerable devices to human beings that could take care of it. There's definitely organizations where even with a nice IT team, the ratio of IT professionals or security professionals is still going to be like 1 to 100 or even more.
I thought it was interesting they were talking about force fields again. As a team, we've talked about how it's not necessarily the threats that hit the outside wall, hit the force field, but are already inside of your environment that are the most vulnerable. Once somebody gets in, whether it's through social engineering, whether it's through somebody's password being out of compliance or whatever malware happens internally, is where the greatest threats seem to be now. And that's where automation is key, being able to analyze behaviors and verify that the right things are happening inside your organization. And that's a good place for robots and automation and systems to keep tabs on what's going on inside your house.
And it's also good that the government is responding to all of these security threats. I want to applaud Illinois. They're requiring all state employees to get cybersecurity training. And I think it's a great initiative to cultivate a security mindset, because for a while now, everybody's been saying everyone is in IT, whether or not they know it. But I'm going to rock the boat and share some news. There's a security researcher in Germany, and we'll be releasing this interview soon, but she said that security awareness and training might not help in terms of preventing clicking on a phish email, because attackers are able to exploit our emotions. So for instance, if hackers knew that we had an expense reporting system and rejected all our expenses, you know, nothing gets people more riled up when, you know, you use your own credit card and your company fake rejects it. And I'm not saying no to training. I'm just saying that getting the right kind of training is also really important.
I like this a lot. I think it's absolutely necessary in the era that we live in. The way that I thought about it is, if you think about any other profession that's existed in the past where people had to train you on how to do it correctly and safely, you know, the safety would be often a huge component of that. You know, making sure if somebody is a chef, you know, teaching them how safely to handle food, how to not burn their hands on the stove. You know, you can learn how to cook something, but you need to know how to do it without causing yourself or other people's any damage. We've been working with computers for so long without having that same sort of security mindset, and then understanding that while these are the tools that everyone is using to do their jobs, the knowledge of how to safely use them hasn't always been at the front of people's minds. And I think that with the rise in breaches and attacks we're seeing recently, it's becoming more and more of a priority, whereas really it should have been a priority from the start.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, any trade people enter, I mean, sort of traditional trades, I mean, like, you know, being able to meet OSHA requirements and safety requirements, do the job safely, kind of handle the process, is always treated as, you know, just as important, maybe not just as important, but very important as well as the actual substance of the work. And I mean, for information workers, and by that I don't necessarily mean people in information technology or information security, but really anybody whose job involves manipulating information, you know, on a computer, that, you know, kind of field hasn't really caught up, kind of reaching some of the same understandings and coming to the same conclusions as some other fields. So maybe it's about time.
Well, at the end of the day, we're also talking about humans. And humans throughout history have been susceptible to cons, hacks, whatever you want to call it. Somebody trying to get something through surreptitious means, it's going to continue to happen. We just have a great internet now that it connects us to everybody and anybody in the world that just make it a lot easier to get to somebody. I was listening to a thing the other day about a pre-internet hack where somebody just sent floppy disks and said, hey, look at this floppy disk. And it was a basic ransomware attack that said, I've got your computer now, you need to pay me this money. That was pre-internet.
Yeah, now isn't there a lot of ransomware? I mean, maybe not, I don't know if it's a lot, but a lot of times they get it into well-secure areas or highly secured areas by just dropping, you know, flash drives, you know, in parking lots, you know, outside of secure areas. And eventually someone's going to bring one inside and plug it in. You know, it relies entirely on human security, you know.
At the end of the day, it's about humans, and it's about humans knowing what they're doing and being able to make sure the humans are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
The UK government also gets a shout out. They just released some guidelines for computers on wheels, also known as a car, They really also get kudos for embracing GDPR. After Brexit, people weren't sure if they're going to adapt it, but we just got news that they are. So that's really great. But, you know, the UK, they really get that everything is connected, and we want to make sure that cars don't accidentally hurt our important humans who are now more cyber aware. And granted that the guidance isn't super detailed like GDPR, but it, you know, it's better than nothing. My favorite concept is security by design. That means security is embedded at every stage of the car design. And if we have that mindset, we'd be better off. Was there a principle that stood out in your mind?
I actually think that security by design is actually the thing that, stands out the most. I mean, because, you know, you think about previous examples of security, you know, in terms of information where it's tacked on after the fact, you know, and that means that, you know, you don't necessarily have a way of securing it at its core. I mean, it sounds almost common sense, but to bake it in from the beginning fundamentally means that structurally it may be built in a way that makes it easier to secure, as opposed to trying to build in backdoors after the fact and potentially kind of destroying the integrity of the overall system. I mean, that's very theoretical, I guess, but it always stood out to me. I remember, you know, back when we talked, this was a while ago now, but we talked about requirements for encryption and backdoors. We talked about Apple and iOS. There was the, what was that, with the San Bernardino case? The idea of kind of forcing in a backdoor after the fact, kind of destroying the integrity of the system overall, could not just have security, but operational implications. It's, yeah, so security by design from day one at every stage of development, I think, is absolutely vital.
The other interesting thing about this article is that this is the first time I've seen a government step up and say, here are some guidelines for developing software to be more secure. And I think that's going to be how we continue, and how government has to be aware and be cognizant and provide the guidance to the companies who are building the software and building the systems that we're going to be relying on more and more in the future.
I think it's fascinating that we're living in a world where now we're talking about how to properly update your car. I think this is going to be something that we see more and more of in the future, not necessarily as a government regulation. I would hope so, honestly, but I think people are going to have to keep a mindset about even the devices and objects they saw as purely physical, you know, realm stuff, and not, you know, things that are previously were not as connected as they are eventually going to be. And we're going to have a similar mindset going forward, making sure that all those handled properly from start to finish, as Faris was saying.
I mean, it started with phones. You know, I think phones and PCs from a personal device standpoint, but it's only going to branch out further and further as, you know, network connectivity and things like that kind of impact more parts of our lives. I mean, cars seems like a natural next step.
Sure.
So for all the IT people that have to carry out training, follow government guidance or regulations, you might enjoy this. Swift on security tweeted out a Dilbert comic where he asked, when you delete software, where do all the zeros and ones go? And then he was mocked for asking that question. And Swift on security said that file systems are very complex. Deleting is also a very complex subject. Can you guys explain why?
A lot of times, and I'm not sure if this is universal across all OSs, I believe it's how it works in Windows at least, and keep me honest on this, guys. When you delete a file, you're not necessarily deleting the file, you're deleting the reference to that file. You know, the storage device you're using, those ones and zeros are still there, but your OS basically says, oh, I've forgotten where that is. So the data is not necessarily gone. You can definitely go and overwrite it, but you can't guarantee that over the course of using it, you're going to overwrite that data with something new. I mean, there's always a possibility of it, which is why there's software out there that you can take a hard drive and say, well, you know, I'm going to see what's actually out there and forget what the OS says. Those bits are technically still there, and you can recover a lot of this information, which is why people go through the trouble of putting drills through their hard drives and trying to destroy the platters and things like that after the fact to make sure that even though I've quote unquote deleted this file, nobody can go and recover it.
That's very true. And on top of that, there are tools that will zero out the drive. So you can get something that is just going to write a zero into every bit of storage. But then you have the automatic backups and the cloud backups and the replication things that are going on in a standard IT environment. So you deleted that file, but how many other places did that file exist on the network that you don't know about anymore?
That is a really good point. you know, for the longest time, I feel like we've been operating based on this sort of like 90s, 2000s perspective of, you know, data resides on a local machine. But people kind of talked about the cloud being the future for a couple of years. And I think people got a little, I don't know, desensitized to it. But it's sort of, the cloud is, we're a couple of years into it for sure. You know, I mean, there's within an environment, sure, you know, you might have file replication across file servers. You know, you might be talking about backups, but also you might be talking about, you know, replication to a cloud account. You know, where do you have people who are not even realizing that, you know, they're backing things up to iTunes, you know? Yeah, that's a, it's a tricky thing to kind of know when that happens, you know, to know when there's replication at play and when you might have multiple copies of files out there.
And in an organization, are you aware of all those things that are happening? Are you aware of the Dropbox accounts that your people are using?
Yeah.
So the people who have to carry out GDPR responsibilities, where people make requests for their information to be deleted, that's going to be a little difficult and a challenge, right?
But then, you know, when you think about the building out of an infrastructure within an environment, within an organization, you know, the information infrastructure, you kind of need that security by design, you know, from day one. You know, do I have like a DLP in place so that I know when things are taken outside the network or preventing them from going outside the network? Security by design doesn't necessarily need to mean when new software is being developed, but it can be like, you know, when infrastructure engineers within a company are building something out based on solutions from vendors. Are they kind of approaching it from day one with a, will this combination, will this system of from day one be secure? I mean, that's the question, I think.
Even though we focus a lot on digital systems and data breaches, thieves and attackers don't have to be very sophisticated. It can be as simple as digging through your trash to look for names and numbers. And cybersecurity expert and author Scott Schrober reminded us that a paper shredder had various shred counts as a security level. So paper, you can shred them to anywhere between 40 strips or as high as 13,000 pieces. The NSA goes a little bit further to as high as 15,000 pieces. And it's interesting with a tangible piece of property, the security, the idea of security is about shredding it up to pieces. Whereas with digital services or property, it's more about the layers of security, not walls. What kinds of parallels did you make in thinking about this piece?
First thing I thought of, actually, and we may get to this in another podcast, I saw parallels between this and the complexity of passwords in the sense that a lot of the times it's not necessarily about making things impossible to recreate or impossible to figure out, but drastically increasing the amount of time that it would take. They made a point about, you know, the strip cut, the lower level security, 40, 50 strips versus then the next one being like 200 little squares versus 2,000. And the amount of time you could take to recreate that, or the difficulty or the effort it would take, increases by how many, you know, tiny little pieces you're making of that paper. Likewise with the password, the more complex the password, the goal is to make it so that something that is running on in an automated fashion trying to break the password can't do it in a matter of minutes. It'll take hours or days or weeks or months, depending on how truly complex it is. So that's the immediate parallel that I saw. Now, Cindy, I think I sent you an article about this not too long ago about how the password complexity, the person who originally devised the idea or advocated for it, got it wrong. So maybe we'll talk about that another time. But I still see that these are very similar, just a matter of effort required to get that information.
Piggyback on top of passwords, we can also talk about endpoint encryption. How difficult is it to actually read the data that you can get access to? Can we use PGP or whatever encryption package of your choice with a private key to keep people from reading the stuff once they do get a hold of it, if they do get a hold of it?
And finally, it was reported that Uber drivers, they gamed the system to cause a surge in price. And I wondered if we'd see more of this in the future when algorithms rule our lives. But I also thought that, you know, consumers can take advantage of technology flaws or bugs or human error. Consumers, I've seen them buy a ticket to South Africa for $100 rather than $1,000.
I think we're talking about capitalism in its basis form. Everybody's going to be trying to get an angle over everybody else and have been for however long we've had market-driven economies. You just see it now with Uber and, you know, the internet gig age, where they can communicate as a community to say, hey, let's all hang out for a little bit and turn our apps off so we can drive the price up in an hour. It's just a communication tool that You know, before in the olden times, they would have to sit in dark rooms with big cigars to come up with such ideas.
Kind of reading this, when I first read it, I was actually expecting it to be sort of a, they didn't even realize they were colluding, but like everyone's kind of individual behaviors, kind of, it was like, I thought it was going to be like some amazing little study of like the sociology of groups or something like that. But then, no, I mean, it ended up just being like they found like the posts online where they're actually colluding, which I found interesting. But I mean, that's really just as inevitable, though. I would argue in a case like this, you know, when you have like an algorithm like that, people figure it out and then we'll find a way to make it benefit them. You know, I kind of see it as inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of feels to me like manipulation of any other market that's out there, except this market is about the cost of a ride home as opposed to the cost of a stock or something like that. Same sort of situation in which people are, you know, as gaming the system effectively. This definitely makes me annoyed because I've definitely paid for surge pricing before. But yeah, that's, I could definitely see the parallels there.
True. I mean, I've definitely seen, you know, like tweets and things like that where it's like, oh, hey, this company like accidentally put up a discount. Everybody jump on it, you know, and then a company is like, do they honor the discount, you know, and keep the goodwill, or do they back out of it, but potentially, you know, kind of infuriate the people who, or alienate the people who, you know, got that deal. I mean, you do see people jump on kind of algorithmic errors pretty often. I mean, I guess in this case, it kind of proves that it's on both sides of the, was it supplier, consumer, on either side of that border.
Well, and then you'll see the consumers finding the same posts online or the tweets and saying, hey, I'm not going to use an Uber now. And so their little game is up.
Instead of a tool of the week, I want to share a certification I learned about while I was at Black Hat. I met a gentleman, LaRoyal Stevenson, and he was studying for the Offensive Security Certified Professional 24-hour test, where students can prove that they can work on an unknown network, enumerate the targets within their scope, exploit them, and document their results in a report. Pardon the noisy background, it was a busy show.
What's your name?
LaRoyal Stevenson.
And how long have you been in cybersecurity?
I've been in cybersecurity for a little over 3 years.
And then what tests are you working on right now or getting certified in?
So right now I'm waiting to the test for the OSCP exam.
What does that stand for?
Offensive Security Certified Professional. A little bit about the OSCP certification. Yeah, you have your lab time. And then, which I, you know, I paid 90 days lab time. So you have lab time, then you have the actual certification itself, which is a 24-hour exam through Office of Security, through their actual network, their VPN network. You VPN into it. You have certain machines that you have to exploit within 24 hours. And then in turn, you have another 24 hours to make a penetration testing report. This is something that anybody could get.
This is something anybody can get.
Yeah, this is something.
And how long have you been studying for this 24-hour test?
I've been studying for over a year before I got into lab time. And then the lab time, I mean, it helps. You could get lab time and learn some things. You know, they have a course that goes along with the lab time, but in my opinion, it's not sufficient enough because it's not an easy.
Right.
It's not known to be an easy certification to get. I would say anybody that wants to really get into it, there's different sites that also host free lab time, like Hack the Box. There's another site called Pentested. So it's similar to OSCP, but it's their own version of it. There's also BoneHub, where you can download actual virtual machines, and you can hack into those as well.